Now, last week we talked about religious pluralism, this big movement, the new tolerance, the idea that all beliefs are equally true, all behaviors equally wholesome, and how we need a vibrant Christian defense. And, we talked the week before about postmodernism, denial of absolute truth, denial of absolute morality. And so where does that leave us today? Well, it leaves us with trying to do what the church has done for the past 2,000 years, and that's contending earnestly for the faith once for all with the saints, Jude verse 3. Now, 1 Peter 3:15, we're commanded to make a defense of the hope that is in us yet with gentleness and reverence. Paul in Colossians 4, 5, and 6 tells us to deal with wisdom towards the outsiders, those who are outside the church, to be able to answer their objections. Titus 1, 9 says that the overseer not only should be able to exhort and encourage people in sound doctrine, but refute those who contradict. So we are called to do apologetics, just as Peter, Paul, and John did apologetics, provide evidence for the Christian faith. But what type of apologetics can we look for in the 21st century? And this is what I'm basically closing up our series on history of Christian thought. Where do we go from here? How shall we now live? As you know, the question of Francis Schaeffer threw up, quoting from the scriptures. So I'm going to make a few suggestions for the 21st century and what kind of what our apologetics might have to look like. Now that we've entered the 21st century, right now, this is 2006 that I'm speaking. But in order to do that, what I want to do is just take a look back at some of the 20th century apologetic methodologies, some of the different ways that great Christian thinkers defended the faith in the 20th century. Some of these guys are still alive, and some of these guys are actually in their prime. And when I come across one of those guys, I'll let you know. But different apologetic methodologies. You have the traditional apologists. The traditional apologists basically believe that there is neutral or common ground between the believer and the non-believer from which we can take agreed-upon premises and argue to Christian conclusions. Okay? And so traditional apologists like Norman Geisler from Southern Evangelical Divinity School, North Carolina, he's basically a Protestant Thomist, a follower of Aquinas' argumentation. And, you know, if you want to look into Geisler, let me talk about several guys, but Geisler, Van Til, Gordon Clark, and Francis Schaeffer, their apologetic methodologies, I've given handouts on it. We're not going to be able to go that in depth on that, otherwise this course would just go on and on indefinitely. But the Advanced Apologetics course, there's a few lectures devoted to their apologetic methodologies. Also, my No Other God, they have the Vantillian apologetic methodology, and as well as Gordon Clark's, so if you want to look into it further. But whatever the case, Norman Geisler, traditional apologist, he's famous for, you know, in his apologetics textbook, the first one third of the book is just methodology. How do we find truth? And he looks at agnosticism, saying, well, man can't know truth. That fails. Pure rationalism fails because it can only prove what is false. And then reason, if you can prove everything through reason alone, you've got to prove your first principles through reason alone. But then they wouldn't be first principles. And you go back on and on, an infinite regress of evidences. So pure rationalism can never even get started. And he just goes through fideism, experientialism, evidentialism, pragmatism, combinationalism, combining these different methodologies. And he shows that in the end, they still fail. So he comes up with his own tests for truth, which are very Thomistic. Unaffirmability is the test for falsity of worldviews. You can't affirm something without contradiction. It has to be false. Okay? And then actual undeniability as the test for truth of worldviews, where Norman Geisler argues, like for instance, instead of saying, I think, therefore I am, like an ultra-rationalist, like Rene Descartes, Geisler would say, in order to deny my existence, I have to exist in order to make the denial. So it's actually undeniable that I exist. Just to deny my existence, I have to exist to make the denial. And then there has to be a systematic coherence basically there can't be contradictions within your worldview. Within the worldview, it must be non-contradictory. It must be empirically adequate, must explain the relevant facts, and experientially relevant. It must be livable. And then he goes into theistic apologetics and argues that the other worldviews fail. Theism is actually undeniable. And then he goes to Christian apologetics, and through historical evidences, he argues that of the three main theistic faiths, Christianity, Judaism, and Islam, only Christianity has the true picture of Jesus. So there's an example of a traditional apologist. William Lane Craig, J.P. Moreland, they usually start out with the Kalam cosmological argument for God's existence. They argue that everything that has a beginning needs a cause. The universe had a beginning, therefore the universe needs a cause. Then from there, they get, once they prove God's existence, they go into heavy historical evidences for Jesus' resurrection and Jesus' deity and the reliability of the New Testament. Gary Habermas and John Warwick Montgomery are two examples. Gary Habermas, a philosophy professor at Liberty University, and John Warwick Montgomery, he's elderly now and he's in Europe, but in the 1960s he was really big. But they're real big on historical evidences for Christianity. Habermas is cutting edge. Habermas and Craig are probably the two most cutting edge evangelical apologists when it comes to historical evidences for Christ. R.C. Sproul, a Reformed scholar who's a traditional apologist. The late Dr. Walter Martin wrote Kingdom of the Cults. I'm mentioning him because of the importance for comparative religious apologetics like that which Walter Martin did. That's becoming more and more important in our pluralistic society. We need to not only argue that Christianity is true, but argue that other religions and cults are false. Walter Martin went a long way on that. Probably the most famous traditional apologist of the first half of the 20th century was C.S. Lewis, the brilliant man. He used his arguments were very Thomistic, very much like Thomas Aquinas' argumentation. It was more geared towards the layperson. Yet Lewis, the late Dr. Francis Schaeffer, also went into cultural apologetics. He argued in his work, The Abolition of Man, that because in English textbooks for grammar school children in Great Britain, they were teaching that there's no such thing as right and wrong, this is going to lead to the abolition of men. The abolition of man is going to lead to men, a race of men without chests, men without moral consciences, people who don't know right from wrong, don't believe in right and wrong, and it's going to create a slave mentality where the few are going to be, the billions are going to be controlled by the few. And the laws are going to be set up, arbitrary laws, just to protect the state, those in power. He referred to these people, C.S. Lewis did, as the man-molders of the New Age. That was before we even had the phrase the New Age movement. And but these were all traditional apologists. They argued much along the lines of Christian thinkers throughout the centuries. Now, what happened was due to Darwinian evolution and the modernistic thinking of the Enlightenment, where we almost deified, almost worshiped human reason and threw God out the window, a lot of Christians were then thinking of going the Søren Kierkegaard route into fideism, that we believe against the evidence, that there's no real evidence for faith. We believe against the evidence, or at least apart from the evidence. But a halfway house developed as a result of the modernist attacks on Christianity. And we have too many, hear me out on this, we have too many Christian lay people, and now even Christian philosophers and thinkers, who act like Cornelius Van Til and his transcendental presuppositionalism for Gordon Clark's presuppositionalism, they act like this is a back to the Bible movement. Now we're doing apologetics the way the apostles did. Baloney. That is not the. There would have been no presuppositionalism if the evangelical church didn't cave in to pressure from modernistic thinking. Okay, and believe me, I think there's some great contributions by Van Til and Gordon Clark at the same time to say only our arguments can be used and nobody else's. I really think presuppositionalism gives people in the end an excuse for non-belief rather than defends belief. Okay. Having said that, there are some good things that can be said for the presuppositional camp. Presuppositionalism, what it means is this. You assume Christianity to be true, and then you argue from Christianity to other things. You don't argue from other things to Christianity. Here's one of the major philosophical fallacies of both presuppositional camps. They act like because we argue from things first, from premises to God, that there's a chronological priority of other things placed before God in order of time to get to the God conclusion, they act like that's idolatry. So they confuse chronological priority with ontological priority, as if whatever your first premises are, if it's not God, it's idolatry. And you're stuck in human autonomy or whatever. And that's just not the case. I mean, Philip led Nathaniel to Christ. So first Nathaniel, then Philip, then he knew Christ. So he knew Philip first in time. That doesn't make Philip more important than Christ. And so I think this is a big category mistake here. Part of it is also due to their Calvinistic views. They believe, Van Til and Gordon Clark believe that regeneration precedes faith. So God either regenerates you or he doesn't. So in the end, why use traditional apologetics to try to persuade somebody to become a Christian if the Holy Spirit's either going to zap you or he's not going to zap you? But to be totally honest with you, with that same kind of reasoning, why even share your faith? But these guys do share their faith, and they do defend the faith, although they only use their own type of argumentation. So Van Til, so presuppositionalism, you presuppose the truth of Christianity and the scriptures as God's word, and then you argue from that. So you argue from Christianity, not to it. Now, Van Til admits he's arguing in a circle. He argues from Christianity to something else, back to Christianity. He's arguing a circle, but he argues that all argumentation is circular, and then he says that it's a beautiful circle, you know. But arguing a circle has traditionally been considered a logical fallacy. But Van Til would say that apologetics must start with the presupposition that the triune God exists, and he has authoritatively revealed himself in Scripture. So all non-Christian reasoning presupposes human autonomy. This is why they're opposed to traditional apologetics. They say that, well, you're assuming that people that non-Christians can reason in an unbiased manner, and you're starting with non-Christian principles and trying to argue with God. You're compromising. That's what the way they argue. And so what Van Til would say is this, that the transcendental arguments, those are the necessary conditions for human knowledge, human experience, human existence. His transcendental argument says that all human thought and moral judgments would be impossible if Christianity is not true. So Van Til would say things like, if God does not exist, we know nothing. He also said self-consciousness presupposes God-consciousness. The knowledge of the self presupposes knowledge of God. Arguing about the he would say, Vantola would say, arguing about the existence of air is similar to arguing about the existence of God, because one needs air in order to argue. So if you argue against the existence of air, you're taking in air the whole time. If you're arguing against God, presupposing that you actually, human reason really works, and that's assuming, presupposing that God exists. Now let me say this, I like the transcendental argument. Except for this, I think if you say, if God, then knowledge and morality and truth, but then it goes the other way. If knowledge, morality, and truth, then God. And the presupposition says, no, you can only go in one direction. That's an arbitrary decision on their part. I think you can argue both ways. But when the atheist is arguing atheism is true, if he's a consistent atheist, he's also arguing, okay, atheism is true because God doesn't exist. By the way, if God doesn't exist, then there is no absolute truth. Well, wait a minute, Mr. Atheist. If there is no absolute truth, then atheism can't be true. So the atheist, by taking the debate as a consistent atheist, he's really already forfeited the debate. He's already lost the debate. So there's something to the transcendental argument. The only problem is, though, Vantilla is saying this is the only argument you can use. Greg Bonson was one of his brilliant students, and that's what he would use as well. John Frame, let me say this, John Frame, Steve Cowan, one of the mentors for Columbia Evangelical Seminary, brilliant guy, but his five views on apologetic methodologies, he's got John Frame, a former student of Vantil, defending the Vantillian position. John Frame is not a Vantillian presuppositionalist. All you have to do is read what he says about it, and you'll see that's why he calls himself a presuppositionalist of the heart. Which means he's not a presuppositionalist of the mind. He's a cumulative case apologist. Okay? But John Frame critiques the transcendental argument, which means he can't be Vantillian. No matter how much respect he has for Cornelius Vantil, he's not Vantillian. But he says that all someone has to do is question one of the premises of the transcendental argument, and automatically you have to use other arguments and other pieces of evidence to defend it. Or you just concede the point and lose the debate. But once you use other arguments, then it can't be the only argument. So the whole Vantillian system of defense comes crumbling down. Let me say this. R.C. Sproul, John Gerstner, Lindsley, they wrote classical apologetics, and they tried to refute Vantillian apologetics. They misunderstood Vantil at one of his most important points. They claimed that he was saying that in Romans 1, the revelation of God through nature doesn't get through to the non-believing man. That's not what Vantil is saying. Vantil is saying all men deep down inside know that God exists, but they deceive themselves and suppress this truth. So Vantil did equivocate a lot. That's why you got to go to Greg Bonson's writings to find out what Vantil taught. Vantil was not a great communicator. John Frame admitted that. Bonson admitted that. Many of his students admitted that. But these guys, what Vantil is arguing, he's saying there's no neutral ground because everybody's biased. Okay? Yet, there is common ground between the believer and the world. Because we have to live in God's universe where there's moral values and human reason, but it's Christian ground. So Cornelius Vantil says to do anything worthwhile, the non-believer has to borrow capital from the Christian worldview. So Vantil would say that for argument's sake, Christians can place themselves within the unbeliever's presupposition. To show that one has to presuppose the truth of Christianity just to raise an objection against Christianity. As Greg Bronson stated, there's no way a person could give moral values or rationality from molecules in motion. So whenever a person thought about moral values and rationality, it presupposes something like the Christian God. Let me say this. I think this is a strong apologetic methodology, but I don't see anywhere that just to have that our knowledge presupposes the existence of a triune God and that he has revealed himself in the Bible. So if I had to really pinpoint where I am, I would probably classify myself as a theistic presuppositionalist, not a Christian presuppositionalist. Now, I'm a Christian, but what I'm saying is, just to reason and to make moral value judgments and to debate presupposes that we live in a world, a rational universe and a moral universe, which presupposes a rational and moral grounding or foundation for that universe. So I think all thought and all communication presupposes the existence of a personal God. But I think it's an arbitrary presupposition to just say there has to be the triune God and things of that sort. Now, having said that, as a theistic presuppositionalist, if you want to classify me as that, then I would take another step and say, but I'm a theistic presuppositionalist who argues that once we realize we have to presuppose theism, that opens the door to traditional apologetics rather than slamming the door on it. Okay? And so we can argue from God to morality and truth, but we could also argue from morality and truth to God. Okay? Whatever the case, you could look into those lectures on Van Til and Gordon Clark, but Van Til, you have to use his traditional, transcendental argument. No other argument will work. And the late Greg Bahnsen was probably the greatest proponent of Van Til's thought. With Gordon Clark, from the face-to-face discussions and telephone discussions with Dr. David Hoover, who was a colleague of Clark's at Covenant College, another philosophy professor there. I think what we have to say about Gordon Clark is the earlier Gordon Clark, whose methodology should be called dogmatic presuppositionalism. And then there's the later Clark's methodology, which is called scripturalism. Okay? The earlier Clark, his dogmatic presuppositionalism is much stronger than his later scripturalism. Scripturalism, well, let me just mention it in passing. His views evolved to the point, he didn't admit that his views changed, but his views did. His views evolved to the point where he argued or he believed that all truth could only be found in the scriptures. So you couldn't find any truth through sense perception, so the apostles really couldn't know Jesus rose from the dead by him appearing to them and them sensing, seeing him, hearing his voice, touching his wounds. We get no knowledge whatsoever from sense experience. And all truth is only found in the Bible. So basically, if it's not in the Bible, it's just not true. So he believed we found no truth whatsoever through science. Science just finds formulas that work. It doesn't really give us any truth. And let me say this. That's a perversion of the Reformed doctrine of sola scriptura. Sola scriptura says that the scriptures alone are our final authority for issues of faith and practice. Sola scriptura does not say there's no truth outside the Bible. Okay? But if somebody's teaching us something and it's in an area of faith or beliefs, we test it with the scriptures and we can tell if it's false or not. Even if the Bible mentions anything that is God's word, it's true. So if somebody says something that historically contradicts the Bible, well then that history, supposed history, is pseudo-history, and the biblical history, historical account, is the true one. So the scripturalism is, it's about as close to a non-Christian. It sounds real holy. Truth is only found in the Bible. But in reality, the Bible contradicts that over and over and over again. It talks about God revealing himself to us through nature. It talks about God's moral laws written on our hearts and our consciences. It talks about Jesus proving that he rose from the dead by physically appearing to the apostles. The list goes on and on. So the problem with scripturalism, it's not scriptural, okay? And it got to the point where Gordon Clark's views seemed to raise questions about the reality of the physical world existing outside our minds. I mean, he even said all truth is propositional. And And so even the three persons of the Trinity, he defined a person as a list of true propositions about that. And so even personhood gets broken down into propositional statements. So his scripturalism is way at the lunch. But his earlier dogmatic presuppositionalism, what he said that was rationalism fails to find truth, empiricism, trying to find truth in the five senses, that fails. Irrationalism fails, like existentialism. Unaided human reason results in skepticism, where we can't really know anything. And so Clark's view is dogmatism. He says, look, we have to... He says, reason works, but the problem is you can't prove your first principles. Because if you could prove your first principles wouldn't be first principles. The proofs for them would be. But then you'd have to be able to prove your proofs. And you go on and on. So reason has to start somewhere. He says, look, we have to dogmatically presuppose something. And so he says, well, you know what? Let's dogmatically presuppose the existence of the triune God who's revealed himself through scriptures, and let's presuppose the reality of the law of non-contradiction, what he called the law of contradiction, okay? And when you presuppose that, lo and behold, it makes perfect sense out of our moral experience and our rational experience. It makes perfect sense out of human life. We can live consistently with it. Whereas any other dogmatic starting point, dogmatic presupposition, leads to a position that's not livable, a position that's not rational. And so I think he's onto something there. The only problem I would have with it, he's acting like you have to have his dogmatic presuppositionalism or nothing else. So the earlier Clark, I think, is a good, strong apologetic methodology if we use it with other methodologies, okay? And his even with his dogmatic presuppositionalism, it's like he's standing in the forest and he has cut down all the trees except his own, the Christian worldview. And they say, well, how do you know your worldview tree is the right one? And he's holding his axe and he says, well, look around. It's the only one that's still standing. Okay? So he refutes everybody else, thus isn't the only one standing. Shows his is consistent and has explanatory power. The problem with that, as Gordon Lewis pointed out, is testing Christianity's truth claims. Even if you cut down all the trees, a new one could grow tomorrow. Somebody could come up with a new worldview. There's no way, unless you're God himself, there's no way of knowing that you've refuted all other worldviews. Okay? His scripturalism, I'm not even going to comment on it, but some of his followers were trying to find the axioms. They were trying to find the axioms of geometry in the Bible. And it's like, you know, come on, guys, get a life. I mean, you have to know certain truths to be able to mow your lawn without cutting off your toe, and you're not going to find those truths in the Bible. Now, you can, Clark's followers can say, well, then it's not true. Yeah, but what do? If your teenage son is not being safe with the lawnmower, do you yell at him because he's not dealing with these supposed untruths? Or do you yell at him because he's not dealing with the truth of the matter? Another real recent apologetic methodology is Alvin Plantinga of Notre Dame. His Reformed apologetics. He calls it Reformed apologetics, but I would argue that John Calvin did not use this apologetic methodology. And so it's not really as Reformed as Plantinga thinks it is. What Plantinga is objecting to is the foundationalism of traditional apologists. Foundation, they believe that there were certain, traditional apologists usually believe there are certain self-evident truths or truths that were logically necessary, and from those foundational truths, you can prove everything else. So there's foundational truths, and from that you can make a defense of God. Well, Plantinga is right that we now question whether or not those truths are really self-evident. and about whether or not they're logically necessary, okay? And so he wants to abandon foundationalism, traditional foundationalism, and say, you don't necessarily have to have your basic beliefs, such as there is a universe outside my mind, a world outside my mind that exists, there are the existence of other minds. It's real difficult, if not impossible, to prove that rationally, because it's always possible that your mind is being deceived or your mind is producing the illusion that there are other minds and things of that sort. So we have certain basic beliefs, the basic belief in the existence of the self, okay? And so what he says is that sometimes our basic beliefs, there's no evidence for them, but a person is still reasonable to hold to them. So let's get away from traditional foundationalism, and let's just say, well, what's wrong with saying God is a basic belief? So in other words, a person says, well, I believe in God, I don't have any evidence for it, but I just have a basic belief that God exists. And he says there's nothing irrational about it. And then he says, and oh, by the way, other people who don't share that basic belief, you can use traditional apologetics to try to lead them to that belief. The only problems I would have here is he's too quick to just toss out foundationalism. All we have to, there are some things, like the law of non-contradiction. There are certain truths that we can't reject without contradiction. And so, even if we say, well, maybe they're not logically necessary or self-evident, we say that there's sort of certain truths that have such a high degree of probability of being true that only a fool would deny them. And then even when he denies them, he has to live as if they're true anyway. That I think that we just need more humble foundationalism. That's one thing. Number two, I think even people who think they believe in God without evidence, they have good evidence for believing in God. It just might be evidence of a different type, such as experiencing God, seeing a sunset or whatever, singing a praise song, feeling God's presence, being alone and crying out to God in prayer for help. You really sense that somebody is there listening. So I would go even beyond basic belief. I would say that I would agree with St. Bonaventure that there's an innate knowledge of God, an immediate knowledge of God that everyone has, but we like to suppress that truth, as Paul says in Romans 1. And so therefore then we need traditional apologetic arguments and stuff. So I would, some of my terminology would change, but I think planning is just going a little bit too far with foreign apologetics. Calvin believed in immediate knowledge of God and immediate knowledge of God. Sri Calvin's instances. Immediate knowledge of God means there's something in between that gives us knowledge of God. So through nature and through our conscience, okay, but primarily through nature, nature is a mediator between man and God, and that we see nature, the creation, the work of God's hand, so we know that God exists. But then Calvin also argues that there's an immediate knowledge of God, that just by us being created in God's image, even though we're fallen, deep down inside, we know that God exists. But because we're fallen, we suppress that truth. And so I don't even think Calvin was really a reformed apologist. I think Alvin Plantinga is on to something new that is not consistent with his Calvinism. Let me comment on cultural apologetics, and then I'll get back to verificationalism. Well, Francis Schaeffer and C.S. Lewis argue that as Western civilization, because Western civilization embraced belief in the Christian God as the dominant worldview, God blessed Western civilization and prospered her, and we've had all these advances in technology and all. But as Western civilization turns its back on God, things are getting worse and worse and worse. Okay, so Schaeffer called it the death of man. Now that we live in a post-Christian era, we're going to produce the death of man. where B.F. Skinner and behavioralists like him want to get beyond freedom and human dignity and genetically manipulate human beings and control their environment and take away their free will. Lewis called it the abolition of man. So that's cultural apologetics, that's another apologetic methodology. But Francis Schaeffer also had what I would call verificational presuppositionalism. He used the term presuppositionalism like his teacher at Westminster, Cornelius Van Til. However, his presupposition is more like a hypothesis which can be tested, whereas Van Til would not allow his presupposition to be tested. And I think there's a place for verificationalism. I like using a cumulative case type of verificationalism where I would just, you know, say, well, the Christian explanation, okay, the Christian explanation is the most powerful explanation for the world in which we live, okay? His method of apologetic, he allows his presupposition to be tested much like that of a scientific hypothesis. His tests for truth, they must be not, the views must be non-contradictory and explain the phenomenon in question, and we must be able to live consistently with our theory, okay? And then he argues that there must be a personal cause for everything that exists, because we see personhood in the universe, and personhood could never come from a non-personal cause. But I like what Schaeffer said, that the final apologetic said, by this all men will know that you are my disciples if you have love one for another, John 13:35. I think Francis Schaeffer had a lot to contribute. The problem that most philosophers have him is that his language was not philosophically precise, and so they would have some problems with that. But I think the guy that is really onto something, I met him several times and really didn't hit it off well with him. He's a great guy, but he doesn't. You try to joke with him, he doesn't get it, and that type of that. But David Clark, he has a cumulative case apologetics that is person-centered. So it's like he's looking for that hypothesis, that general explanation. And like Francis Schaeffer, the way he described it, it's like a jigsaw puzzle that's missing a few pieces. And Christianity supplies the pieces that make sense out of everything else. It's like finding the key that opens the door to knowledge and morality and truth. And Clark says he's willing to use a cumulative case. And it's person-centered. So if our arguments that might work on one guy might not work on another guy, okay? And so his work is titled Dialogical Apologetics. I recommend you buy that, published by Baker Brookhouse. An excellent work. And that's kind of where I'm at, is I use cumulative case like my... I use the cumulative case for God when I argue against atheists. And I argue that theism is a more plausible explanation than atheism, and then I'll use anywhere from 9 to 13 different aspects of human experience and say that in each one of these, theism is more plausible than atheism, and the evidence for theism, the belief in God, accumulates as you add all these. You could do the same thing with historical evidence for Jesus' resurrection. There's different pieces of evidence, such as the empty tomb, acknowledged by over 70% of New Testament scholars, leading New Testament scholars today. The evidence that it was Joseph Arimathea's tomb. The evidence that women were the first witnesses of the tomb. The evidence that the early church changed the worship day from Saturday to Sunday. I mean, there's the evidence, the case accumulates, the case builds when you say, well, either this or that, well, it's this. Either this or that, well, it's this. Each time you do that, it's not, Geisler says that you're just adding leaky buckets and they'll never hold water. And it's like, well, if the leaky buckets have the holes in the top, so they hold a little bit of water, but not all the water, you add three or four of these buckets together and you got more than one bucket alone can hold. And so I think the cumulative case, you know, and I'll go on record saying I do not believe I will not just say that I won every debate with the atheists that I debated, like Dr. Michael Martin from Boston University and Jeffrey J. Lauder, founder of Internet Infidels, the world's largest atheist website, and Elliot Ratzman and Dr. Peter John and Dan Barker. I will not only say that I defeated them in the debates, I will say they never even... I told them, if you're going to refute me, you've got to prove on each one of my points that atheism is more reasonable of an explanation than theism. And they never do that. They just say, well, the argument doesn't prove God's existence with logical necessity, or it could also prove polytheism or deism or whatever. They just move on, and it's like, you guys just don't get it. Either you don't understand what I'm saying, or you understand what I'm saying, and you know that you don't want to go head-on atheism against theism. But I say that the cumulative case apologetics, making it person-centered, taking Christianity, using it as a hypothesis, as an explanation of the data in question, is the way to go. So what I want to do right now is just make some suggestions for apologetics in the 21st century. There are many Christian lay people who don't like apologetics in defense of the faith. The fact of the matter is, they would not be Christians today if it were not for apologetics, because we wouldn't even know what apologetics is. I mean, if it wasn't for Christian apologetics, we wouldn't know that Jehovah's Witnesses are not Christians. Apologetics has to draw the line between truth and heresy, between the one true faith and false belief systems. So we do need to continue to do apologetics, even on into the 21st century. And so I'm just going to make several really quick suggestions. I think I'm going to make 10 different suggestions. Some of them are very, very similar as to how we can continue to defend the faith in the 21st century. First and foremost, we need to develop a coherent Christian worldview. We need to do more than just defend against attacks against Christianity. We need to do more than just to defend different aspects of Christianity. We also need to build a non-contradictory, coherent Christian worldview as that overall hypothesis or explanation for the data in question. Lots of organizations like Worldview Academy and David Noble's group, Summit Ministries, lots of Christian ministries are doing that, developing a coherent Christian worldview. Number two, it needs to have explanatory power and be able to explain a wide variety of data. People are bringing up objections to the Christian faith that they never brought up before. Now the major objection to Christianity is that it's intolerant. We've got to explain why Christianity is tolerant, and it's the most tolerant. I mean, God actually tolerates people rejecting him, and he allows them to spend eternity separated from him, but that's what hell is all about. And the people who call themselves the tolerant ones are actually the ones who want to throw Christians in prison. They're actually the intolerant ones. So he's got to have explanatory power. Number three, we need to speak the truth in love, as Paul says in Ephesians 4:15. And as that quote from John 13:35, the world will know that you're my disciples when you have love one for another. If we're not going to practice what we preach, we have no business even trying to share the faith. Okay? So number three, we need to speak the truth in love.